Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to another Power of Byth and Symbolism in Star Wars. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host, and with me today, as always, for this segment, Ty Black.
Hi guys! Welcome. Thank you!
Myth is such an interesting thing, and since my interview with Ken Liu, the author of The Legends of Luke Skywalker, which is a fascinating book about mythology in Star Wars, these legends that we hear about the heroes that we know within canon, Ty and I have been talking almost nonstop about it. And I basically bugged her until she read the book.
Yep, pretty much.
And so, Ty, I mean, I think maybe your general impressions, people have heard, you know, if they've listened to the podcast and they've listened to that Ken Liu interview. I don't know that you have to read the book to listen to this podcast, but I really do recommend it. And if you are inspired to go back and read the book after you listen to this, I mean, all the better, because Ken is wonderful. His writing is wonderful. And I loved the book on so many levels. And I think we're going to get into a little bit of that today.
Yeah. And everyone finds their own interpretation of what's happening in that book, because it is so disconnected from the rest of canon, because it is this obscure way to tell many stories, many different types of stories. I feel like everybody would find something different. So yeah, it's definitely one thing to listen to our interpretation of it, but it's another thing to like read it on your own and come up with your own ideas.
So in general, Ty, people have heard my opinion, which I loved it. But what was your opinion of the book?
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So I am not as like familiar with canon novels, Star Wars, you know, expanded content as you are, but from what I have read, this was totally different, and it felt the way that I would feel watching Star Wars for the first time. And I don't think that's like a average thought. I think some people will get that out of it, some people won't. But I definitely felt like a kid reading this story. Not because it's for kids, but because it encompassed the myth so well about Star Wars. And on top of that, it broke off into this very relativism viewpoint of not everything is what you think it is. It's not all black and white. It's more complicated. Everybody is important. Like a lot of the themes in Legends of Luke Skywalker it tied in so well to what Star Wars is all about, but at the same time left some ambiguity about it. Mm-hmm. And that to me felt so good, because as a kid, you're learning what's right and what's wrong, but there's some kind of comfort to take in there's more out there still to learn. Like, you're not going to be able to figure it all out ever. There's always still more to learn. So that's what it made me feel like. It made me feel kind of that wonder and that mystery that I had when I was a kid. It's like, okay, what is this trying to tell me? And
I'm going to quote Ken and say, it produced the effervescent joy of Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
So much.
Yeah.
Like, it was all the fun. It was the headcanon. It was the, you know, the deep dive into mythology, especially Force mythos. Like, there's so much in there. Yeah. It was the transformational nature of Star Wars.
Yes.
It was honoring old stories and yet, you know, looking forward to new ones. And it was teaching the moral lessons of Star Wars that George Lucas tried to teach so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's all of those things, and it's brilliant. I honestly cannot stop talking about this book, even though I've had the opportunity to speak with the author about it. I have had the opportunity to read it multiple times. I've talked with you about it, and now we're actually talking about it from a myth and symbolism perspective, because there is so much symbolic and mythological content in this book that it deserves its own Power of Myth and Symbolism episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, there's I guess I'll talk about the Canterbury Tales connection here.
Yeah, if you can. Yeah, I mean, it is a frame story. Mm-hmm. And there is a very famous frame story called the Canterbury Tales. Did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Very loosely, like not getting too much into it, because this is Star Wars, but I think Ken did express that it was supposed to be a little bit of that. Like, that's kind of his idea of it. But the thing about Canterbury Tales is it's supposed to invoke this sense of you don't know everything. Like, you don't have the whole truth. Not one person has the whole truth. And so the necessity of something like the Canterbury Tales is to tell the story of society without presenting one truth. It's presenting many truths. So it provides a criticism of how things are, and it provides kind of this idea of where things could go, but that is interpreted differently by every single person that reads it. So a lot of people say Canterbury Tales is a critique about religion, or it's a critique about society, or it's just a story to teach people right and wrong. But it's none of those things. It's none of those things, and it's all of those things at the same time, depending on who you are and where you are in your life while you read it. It's an illustration that using that frame story by telling all these little stories is a way to provide more depth and more meaning than you would get out of writing a realistic story. Doing something more satirical but relatable is more meaningful.
That's like the part of myth that is so fundamentally important. And these legends that are being told in canon, mm-hmm. right? So the canon part of it is the Wayward Current, the frame story, these basically young adults, kids even, yeah. some are just teenagers, and they are traveling from Mushi Cluster to Canto Bight, delivering fathers on, you know, this ship.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have some time on their hands. And one night, you know, these kids are like, tell us a story. You know, these adults that look up to them. And they start telling stories about Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
Why Luke Skywalker? And I have to take a moment to say, you know, there is nothing in the book that specifically targets the time the frame story takes place, but I did find something that could indicate, depending on how canon lays out in 9, that it is before 7.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Really? Because that's not been your theory.
No, I honestly, okay, so if 9 ends up happy and there's still a New Republic, then it's after 9. If it does not end up happy and there's no government, it is 7. And before 7. Because they refer to the New Republic customs officers.
Oh my goodness.
In the frame story. And that is the only circumstance that they actually refer to anything that I would consider to point it at any time and place.
Yeah.
But because 9 is not resolved, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I personally think it's after 9. I think things are going to end up happy. I think there's going to be still a New Republic. It's going to rebuild from what it is. It's still going to be called the New Republic. But they actually call it the New Republic Customs Officers.
Huh.
So.
That's the only thing, though.
That's the only thing that makes me question whether it's before 7.
Interesting.
Nothing else. Other than it's set on Canto Bight. If Canto Bight gets destroyed in 9, then yeah. it's before 7. Like those are the things, right? If Fathiers disappear from the universe before the end of the sequel trilogy, then it's before 7. But it's not. I think it's after 9. And I said that in the interview to Ken Liu, and he didn't disagree with me.
Right. No, he didn't. He kind of laid into that one a little bit. He was like, okay, like, next topic. I feel like you hit it on the head by saying it's after 9. And who knows, maybe the New Republic hint in there might be a mistake.
And like, you think about how long it takes to actually build legends and myth. And yeah. what are the legends that we in our society call to? Arthur, you know, Greek and Roman mythology.
Yep. Folk tales.
Norse mythology.
Yeah.
Johnny Appleseed is a folk tale, which is also considered a myth nowadays.
Yeah.
voodoo mythology.
You could say the Grimm tales, yeah.
Grimm fairy tales. All fairy tales are pretty much mythology now, yeah. From a myth perspective. And fairy tales and fables and, you know, Aesop's fables, they all fall under the big, wide universe of myth.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating because it's like, how long does it take for a tale like Johnny Appleseed to become, you know, or even Washington cutting down the cherry tree, which was one of, you know, Ken's specific examples he called to.
Right.
When did that become a legend that we call to say, oh, he did that?
Right.
You know, and George Washington.
And it's not so much about the realistic whether or not he did it. It's about what does that mean to us as a society? What does that mean to us as people who came from that? What is that telling us?
Yeah. It's at least a, like, realistically, it's a couple hundred years to have something fall into legend. It could be less. I mean, I think that, you know, probably some it's harder nowadays because we have, like, photographic evidence. We have video evidence. We have primary sources, which I find this to be such a fascinating thing is, like, my history professor in university used to bug me or used to, like, nail down, like, we have these tales about people, but we have no primary sources, which is primary sources are, you know, like a letter written by them explaining exactly what's happening in the moment or like photographic evidence, or there was a painting taken of them or a likeness taken of them where it shows that their nose was shot off. Like the good Duke Urbino, who like didn't like to have his face painted from one side because he had been hit by a cannonball or something like that. Like there's these things, you know, that we know to be true. And part of the frame story is these legends that are being told, these stories we don't know as the reader or even as the people that are sitting around the table that they're real. But that's not the point. The point is, what are they trying to tell us and what are they telling us? And how are they telling us, right? Some of the legends themselves get you totally off guard. And just like the kids on the Wayward Current that are listening to these stories, we are participating in the experience of it.
Yeah. And the kids that are being told the stories are constantly asking themselves, what is the point of this story? They're very explicitly saying, well, what is the point of that?
Yeah.
And
why tell Star Wars at all? Like, and what I love about this book is that it is a micro version of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And maybe this is the point. This is Star Wars. In fundamental nature, this is Star Wars. This is exactly what Star Wars is. How we tell ourselves legends, how we hear and listen and come back to the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Yeah.
And the collective, iterative, non-linear storytelling that is currently being told and has been told from the beginning, because it was, you know, the first original trilogy. And then, you know, we went to the prequels and then we went to the Clone Wars, which was, you know, kind of midway through the prequels. And then we went, you know, now we're going way in the future. And then we went back to Rogue One and then we went to the future again. Like this jumping around non-linear storytelling, I feel like the Legends of Luke Skywalker is trying to help kids come to the point where they can walk into the franchise and be okay with the fact that they don't know everything all the time. And as they discover new pieces, new fragments of the story, it all starts to clarify.
Yeah,
I want to call back to an experience that I just had last night, which will probably be a couple of months down the road since then, because of how my release schedule works. It takes some time for episodes to come out. But we recently heard the Clone Wars was going to be finished. So we're going to get the last bit of the season that was never produced. And Clone Wars itself is non-linear storytelling. They started with the movie, which happens in the Battle of Christophsis. But at some point in the first season and second season, they go back and tell more stories about that. They show us the important clones that they're going to focus on for six seasons and then go back and show them how they, you know, were batchers together and ended up getting Domino Squad. You know, like it jumps around in this non-linear fashion. Although it's very important to like see it kind of as it's coming out and to get it in motion, it's really interesting to go back and actually see chronologically and the story arcs from a different perspective, looking at it from a different angle and a different perspective and understanding where the stories fit in your mind, but you can only do that once you have more information and once you've viewed the whole perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's something that George Lucas was always attempting to do, because it was, as he was going on his journey writing Star Wars, it's something that he struggled with, I think. Naturally and organically, it happened to be the way that myths are written and how they evolve. And it just happened to be that he tapped into it. So when he wrote like Darth Vader, he was like, okay, there's this, here's this bad guy and here's this hero. Okay, let's focus on the hero's journey. And then he was like, wait a minute, but where did this bad guy come from? Like, who is
how did
this
bad guy happen?
Yeah. And when he started doing that, that's when you start creating those layers that contribute to the overall myth and really compound on those messages that are so important in our society currently. And that's what Clone Wars does, continues on in that same tradition. So, yeah, no, I think that's a part of cyclical storytelling, and that's a part of the collective act of myth making, that style of storytelling. The more you're putting into it from various perspectives, the more you're actually, you're not making it more complicated. You're actually focusing more on those similar points throughout.
Because people learn from the stories that we tell ourselves differently.
Yeah.
Sometimes they need to hear the message in a visual medium like a movie. And that's probably going to be the most, I would say, ambiguous, because they need to tell the story in a particular way.
Yeah.
They are a lot clearer in books about how people feel and what they're trying to say.
Right.
They're really clear in the comics.
Oh, absolutely.
Like how Vader felt, how disconnected he was. He still remembered Padme.
Yeah.
You know, how important Luke was to him. And, you know, they're probably even going to be more ambiguous in the video games, because the purpose of the video, like, and what is the purpose that they're trying to get out of the different medium?
Yeah.
It's so fascinating. And so, like, back to Legends of Luke Skywalker, and I think that what we'll do is we'll just kind of go story by story and kind of talk about them a little bit and what we picked up on from a symbolic and mythological perspective.
Right.
But this book is, in my opinion, one of the most important books to come out from Lucas.
Yeah.
About Star Wars.
Yeah.
It shows what they're trying to achieve. It shows they know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot to be able to know your own story enough to make satire about it. It takes a lot to build a complex myth and legend,
yeah,
like iDroid.
Ugh.
To know your own story enough to do that. And I mean, I'm going to call on you, Ty, to quote things from it, but from the book, because you were great with the quotes. But
yeah,
I mean, the lines themselves are fascinating.
Oh, absolutely.
And I know that we went through this with Ken when I interviewed him, but I think just you and I kind of chatting about it, I especially want to call it the Raylo thing that I forgot to bring up with Ken.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, that was... If people know Raylo, there was plenty in that interview that was Raylo.
I was nervous.
Yeah.
He was so impressive and amazing and generous as an author, yeah, to have the conversation with me and put up with me basically fangirling the whole time.
He loved you back. He definitely did. It was a great interview. I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah. No, but that's something that Raylos will admit to, right, is that they don't care so much about the relationship as they care about Ben coming back to the light.
And Rey being happy. I think also want Rey to be happy. And if they can't be happy together, they just want them to be redeemed and okay mentally.
And that's...
like, just be okay.
That was the big... that was a big message, like, with Ken. Ken was, like, all about, you know... yeah, no one has ever really gone. I mean, the ideas are there in the book, and the ideas were there in the interview. So
it's good.
Yeah, it's good, good stuff.
The Wayward Current.
Yeah.
It is the ship. They have these, like, teens, basically, that are serving as deckhands and father keepers. There's several characters in the story. It primarily focuses around one girl in particular who has helped a stowaway. Mm-hmm. By giving her food,
yep,
to be able to survive.
Yeah.
It starts with kind of them wanting more stories from the
I think it's the cook.
Tyra? Yeah. Tyra? Yeah. Tyra is the one girl. What's fascinating about her is that Tyra was the scavenger, right?
Right.
There's a scavenger from Jakku on the ship. There's Teal, who I don't know that we know much about Teal.
No.
But she helps a girl that eventually names herself
Flux.
Yep. We have Ulina and we have Dwoogan, who tells stories.
Yep.
We have the droid, G2X.
Uh-huh.
G2X also tells a story. And then we have Gokolo.
Okay.
Reddy is the character that is told in the Mythbuster
right.
by Dwoogan.
The frame story within the frame story.
The frame story within the frame story. The the conspiracy story, right? Yeah. And what is so wonderful about this. So this one set me up so bad because I jump in this book. I'm like, this is a nice light book. And the first story, which is called The Mythbuster.
Yes.
And this is like, this is representative of so many aspects of where we currently stand within the fandom. We have headcanon people. We have dissector people. We have explainer people. We have it couldn't work this way because
yes.
light speed doesn't work that way.
Or you can't add more characters to the story in 9. There's enough characters already.
Yeah, like everybody goes through this like, I know best.
Yeah.
The fandom thinks they know best. Mm-hmm.
Always.
In this story, we have a character who is a self-proclaimed engineer who worked for the Imperials who knows best. And in Bar that it's being told, we have someone who we think is Luke, and we have Dwoogan, who is the cook on the Wayward Current. Yep. And she is telling the story from her own perspective. So could be very truthfully something that's there. We also find there's a theme that we see throughout the book, which when Luke has 5 red stripes, it's something that we think is actually him, maybe. It's a little hard to tell because, again, this is legend. We don't know if it's actually him or if it's just some sort of representation of him.
Mm-hmm.
What's fascinating about Reddy's story is that she is all of us and she is none of us all at the same time. Reddy likes to dissect things, come up with her own reasons for why things happen.
Yep.
It's like Snoke is Plagueis.
Yep.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
Yep.
She specifically says that Luke's name is Luke Clodhopper.
Yeah.
And that it was all just old Ben Kenobi gang or something like that.
Yep.
Like it's like all a false story and all made up. And actually it was the Empire that made up this explosion to like basically like of the Death Star. Like there's no way they could have ever built the Death Star and it's all fake. And look, the holo reels were different, which calls back to the different versions that we see of the Death Star in, versus our old VHS tapes versus, you know, the
restored versions.
Restored versions where there's a giant ring and she actually calls that out.
Yeah.
And it's very meta. This whole story is so meta to say, you know, what is going on with this book is, look, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It is like a sorry to the fans. And Luke actually says it in the book. And his quote is, "The heroes of the New Republic didn't think of themselves as heroes. Yeah. They thought of themselves as ordinary men and women who did what they did to restore freedom and justice to the galaxy. For me to challenge her would be giving into fear, and fear that their reputation rather than their deeds were what mattered. It would have led to anger that they were not worshipped by everyone who benefited from their sacrifice. It would have led to hate that the truth was not enough for them, and it would have been giving into the dark side."
Yeah.
And he basically just summarizes it by saying, why not just let her enjoy what she gets out of the things She enjoys telling these stories and to being right.
Yeah.
So why not just let her? Why? It's almost like an anti-troll advertisement. Like, why even give in to the trolls?
Yeah. And because the question, I think, that was it Dwoogen was asking him,
mm-hmm.
was, why didn't you correct her? Like, you know, you're Luke, as far as we know. Why didn't you correct her stories? Why didn't you tell her the true version of them? And he's like, why is that important to you? And that's so speaking to the fans. Why is that important to you? You know, it's just like that. It's that meme, like, shh, let people enjoy things.
Yeah.
Just.
And if they enjoy coming up with crazy speculation, why not just let them enjoy that?
Yeah, exactly. And there's plenty of, like, debates that are enjoyable too. If you're someone who likes to debate things, yeah, you can get into plenty of arguments and whatnot. But if you enjoy that, that is the part of the fandom that you enjoy, and that's okay. But yeah, I think that's a really good message.
Like, especially Reddy is, like, harmless, yeah. Right? Like, she's harmless. She's doing it to have fun, and she's doing it to feel important. Like, she has knowledge. Like, why stop that?
But she is a very, she's a very specific point being made. She's harmless, but she's harmless if you have the right perspective. If you have kind of more of a acceptance of people. I don't know how to say this, because she's kind of annoying. Like, she's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, Dwoogen is frustrated with her.
Yes, very.
Dwoogen is frustrated. In the story, the storyteller is saying, why don't you defend yourself, Luke? Why don't you tell the truth? Why don't you just tell people what this all means and why it was important? And Luke says, but that's not what's important.
Yeah. It's how we.
Right? What I. It's how you
yes,
get it.
Yes, exactly.
You got it. And so why would I take away from their fun when they're still getting something out of the story?
Even though Reddy is very stuck in her ways, very unwilling to listen to other people's opinions. But at the end of her story, when she's telling the story to other people, there's something kind of magical that she shares with them and that they get out of it, even though she was unwilling to compromise with any of her ideas.
She still got a bit of the magic.
Yes, and she shared that with them. And that's important, because that's something that you and I talk about all the time, and one of the reasons why we're both very involved in trying to do, like, the What the Fandom in this podcast is, like, every single person has a different, unique perspective and a different contribution that everyone can learn from. I think that this is the story that's trying to tell us that and trying to remind us of that. And that's amazing.
Yeah. And the fact that you pick up on that is wonderful in and of itself, because you brought that as much as, it's like looking in a mirror, this book.
Yeah.
Right? What are you trying to get out of the story? People who expect to see that this is a mock of the Legends canon by naming it Legends of Luke Skywalker will see a mock of the Legends canon.
Yeah.
This book is a mirror to the fandom.
Absolutely.
And that's what Reddy is telling you. Mm-hmm. Who are you in this story?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Good stuff.
That was, I mean, honestly, like, every story has interesting things to tell us.
Yeah.
So the next story that is told.
Starship Graveyard.
Starship Graveyard.
I love this one.
Ulina tells this story.
Yeah.
About Jakku, based on the fact that we have this scavenger girl who's a former Imperial.
Yeah.
We find out former Imperial or former First Order. One of the two. I think she was with the First Order, her mom. We kind of find that out a little bit in the Frame story.
Right.
Do you want to talk about it? Because you seem to really love this one.
Yeah, she's telling it. She heard it before. It's passed down from person to person to person to her. So it's obviously right away it's been kind of jumbled around a little bit. Like, that's what we're supposed to get out of this. So the story is not reliable. But also, it starts obviously with the battle over Jakku. And so there's, it's the guy. Does he have a name?
We never find out his name. He is
perfect.
He's the Imperial gunner.
Yes, perfect. So yeah, we start with him, and he very quickly gets knocked out. But the war itself, like the descriptions of it, are brutal.
Yeah,
they're very brutal, especially for a kid's, like a junior novel.
They don't treat kids like kids. No. They treat kids like humans.
Absolutely,
which is fascinating. Much like Clone Wars, never. I mean, we just like rewatched it, and like there's death and destruction, and clones die in front of the screen.
Yeah.
And like it doesn't play with these themes. It just refocuses you onto what's important. But in the Starship Graveyard, this gunner hits his head, and he has this vision. It's like, I think it's a wanted ad or something like that.
It's a hologram of Luke.
Yeah. And you've played the Battlefront game where he's not there.
No, he's not there. There's no way he could have been there. It doesn't make any sense that he would have been there. When I read this one, I think you told me before, there's no way he could have been there. And I'm reading it and I'm like, well, maybe he was there.
Well, and like he has this vision because I think what is happening in it is that he's seen the Hollow and he imagines the Hollow is pulling the Star Destroyers towards Jakku.
Yes.
Oh, man. There's so much Jakku.
There's so much there. There's so much there.
Layered in there. Like, how did they win? Yeah. Like, that's like, how did they win on Jakku? It didn't make sense to this guy that they lost on Jakku and that these Star Destroyers fell from the sky. Yeah. So, I mean, Ty and I, we're going to speculate just for one moment if you'll please. There's something about Jakku.
There's something weird with Jakku and its magnetic fields.
And they're going to go back to Jakku. I think there's some sort of weapon on Jakku or something, mm-hmm. and it activated. We also know Jakku was a former mining location, which is also really interesting. And we'll bring it up in a future episode, which is really interesting. But yeah, the Imperials lost on Jakku.
Yeah.
Does it make sense that they lost on Jakku? I don't know. I haven't actually played the Battlefront games or read.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. Was it a hard battle?
Well, no. And that's the thing is like Battlefront 2 is where they talk about like Jakku and stuff. And it's like, it is very strange. It's almost glazed over in a way, but it's very obvious that it's like the 300 type thing. Like the...
Oh, like the Imperials...
The Imperials had...
Overwhelming?
Yeah,
them?
They had way more people. They had way more technology. They had the walker. They had the AT-ATs. They had the huge ships and stuff. And it didn't make any sense for them to have lost. But the really cool visual, I think, the coolest visual in like this story was when the character who's telling the story had fallen to Jakku, and he was looking up into the sky and he saw what he thought was Luke Skywalker, but he was huge and he was like hopping from ship to ship and like taking them down
with his lightsaber.
He calls it like a laser sword.
Laser sword. Yeah. Yeah.
That was the only way that could have happened.
And like the funny thing with myth is that if this was mythology in our world, that would be something you would hear about from like a Hercules perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The verbiage that's used in this one, he calls it source.
God.
God. Sorcery, magic, arcane power,
mm-hmm.
Could not be understood by mere mortals. Like all of the.
Yeah. And I think like what this shows is like how scary force users actually are and how rare they are. Like some of them could do a few things, mind tricks, easy things, right? These phenomenal cosmic powers that we hear of or we assume Luke has. Yeah, sure. I'm sure he could actually probably pull a Star Destroyer out of the sky.
Yeah.
He was probably that powerful, but it's how Jedi choose to fight, to quote Yoda, right? And he wasn't there. That's how the galaxy viewed Luke by that point.
Yeah, and that's what this is a good opposite, I think, to the story about the Tide, because this is how Luke saw, or this is how people saw Luke, but the story about the Tide was how I think Luke saw his journey. So, but that's, and we'll get there. But this one was very like, this person, you know, was fearful of this Force user, so much so that he ran away from him several times to try to like
almost dying in the process.
Almost dying. Yeah. Even though he couldn't walk, he was just like dragging himself through the desert and through the sinking sands.
And although this person was somebody who the Imperials did not like, they mutually didn't like each other. This was not Luke.
No, it was probably My best guess is that it was probably somebody that was not on that side, that was not on the Imperial side, that that found him and that helped him.
But believed in what Luke believed in and understood that evoking the memory of Luke gives you power.
Yep. And that, well, that's consistent through this whole thing.
Taking on the mantle of Luke and taking on the mantle of a hero can be done by anybody. And the actual message and quote at the end is, we are all Luke Skywalker.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, if this was Luke, he would have been able to use the Force in a way that would have saved them far sooner than how they actually saved themselves. They used what they had with them, and they kind of, as scrappers, they scrapped together something to be able to get out of their situation. And as they're getting out of the situation, he tells them all, I'm using the Force to guide you. As long as you stay close to me, no harm will come to you. The Force is with us. We are one with the Force. And then it says, the others behind me repeated the mantra. So as they were getting out of that, they were repeating that, like in Rogue One, when the guy says over and over again,
the Force. I'm one with the Force. The Force is with me. Exactly. I'm one with the Force. With Chirrut, yeah.
And it's this really cool, like, because even though we know, from a viewer perspective, the Force is everywhere. The Force is always there. If you believe in the Force will guide you. We know that. But
even if you're not strong with the Force.
Exactly. If you're not a Force user.
Right? All people have the Force in galaxy. Yes,
but having a Force user there makes you feel like there's a pool of power there that's helping you. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was so important for them to believe that they had Luke with them.
Mm-hmm.
So and then obviously, like, the end of that story ends with, we are all Luke Skywalker.
It's very mythological in its nature, in that, like, when you were a hero in, like, Greek and Roman myth, which, although slightly different because of the pantheon and the importance of the different gods in the pantheon, mm-hmm. the legends kind of transfer back and forth. Heracles was Hercules, mm-hmm. etc. They told the same stories because the Romans just took all the stories and kind of made them their own and added on a layer, uh-huh. which is another aspect of myth transformation that I'm hoping we will get to yeah. someday. They very much felt that heroes had patron gods and goddesses that protected them. And that if you were with that person, they had extra power, extra chutzpah, extra stuff behind them that would protect you if you were on the same side and doing the will of these greater beings.
Yeah.
Which is very much in line with, if I'm doing the thing that the Force wants me to do, the Force is with me as well.
Yeah. And that, again, that's compounded with the story later, and some of the other stories later too, compounds that same message, like about using versus allowing yourself to be used. But one more thing before we get too far into it, because we have to talk about that one. One of the other things that happens at the end of the story is that he says, the storyteller says, sometimes the villains are really the heroes. And then they say, I imagine myself as Luke Skywalker. I imagine myself as a luminous being. I survived, barely. And again, it's that imagining yourself as powerful and believing that you can use the Force mm-hmm. is the only thing that you really need. It's just that little that little glimpse of hope. And then obviously right there next to it in the text is, sometimes the villains are really the heroes.
Yeah.
And that was
like, you're like, Kylo, hello.
I was gonna say it's twofold.
Well, no, and Darth Vader too. Oh, right. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's this idea that no one's ever really gone. Yeah. And sometimes exactly. And it is very important for people to take away from this story. So what's important to take away from this story? You, as an active participant in your own life, can choose to do what you need to do to get things done.
Yeah.
That you are in control of your own life, and that you can say, I'm going to be amazing. I'm going to be good. I'm going to rock this. Yeah. And that is what is being said by this, is that we are all Luke Skywalker. We can all step up and be who we need to be.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an element of, if we do this together, we can be better.
Mm-hmm.
If we stop looking at each other on different sides and look at each other, you know, as in we're trying to all accomplish this one goal, which is very simple, you know, then we can be better if we do that. So, yeah, There's a lot in this story. It was the more realistic one, I think, out of all of them. But again, like every single one of these, it compounds the messages into a very short frame.
Snippets. Yeah. It full on says what it's trying to achieve mm-hmm. by the end of each of the stories, yeah. right? It's going to tell you, why let these things bother you in the Ready story? It's going to tell you, we can all be heroes. We can be heroes.
That's what I was thinking too.
Like that song, like we can be heroes. Yeah. That is what it's telling us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed. And then comes the most, I mean, to me, it's the second most, but most people call the next story the most fascinating story. Yeah. And it's told by Flux, the stowaway on the Wayward Current.
Yep.
And what's fascinating is that, like, whenever they introduce a new person who hasn't heard the stories, they take the time, they describe it in the book, they take the time to retell all of the stories to that new person that joins their little coterie as they're going through all of their different adventures within the frame yeah. story. So it's like everybody is aware of all of these stories by the end, which is like, okay, why? Why do they all need to know these stories? I want to see these kids yeah. like do things after.
I know. I thought that was so amazing. Like when the girl shows up with the food for Flux, she's like, I have a story to tell you. Yeah, Teal. She's like, I have a story to tell you. She tells a story and she's
like, oh, I have a story to tell
you. Yeah, also about Luke.
Then we get into Fishing in the Deluge.
Yep.
Oh my word, this story.
I have a lot of highlight. It's pretty cool. I told you this while I was reading it, but because Kindle lets you see where people highlight it, like where it lets you see the popularity of people highlighting it. And it tells you how many times people have highlighted that passage. And there were so many highlights in this one. I was shocked.
Well, I mean, I knew it and I found it very weird when you told me that there was like very little in iDroid.
There were no highlights that I remember in iDroid. Not one.
Whereas I find it to be the most important
story. Yeah.
But let's get into Fishing in the Deluge because I do think it's so fundamentally important. So I didn't really get into this too much with Ken, but it's a retelling of The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
It is.
Absolutely. Luke's entire character in this fits perfectly with what he's gone through.
Who is Luke though?
Luke
is Rey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Luke is Rey. In this story, Luke is Rey. Luke Rey comes to this location seeking knowledge.
And then
and gets turned away by the master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
cuz like I was thinking cuz Luke has gone through this, which sets us up for Last Jedi. But it is a telling of, yeah, you're right. It's Luke is Rey.
In this story.
Yeah. But there is a part. There is a part that mirrors Luke.
The Force Awakens?
Luke and Kylo. And there's a part that mirrors Han and Kylo.
And there's a part that mirrors Rey and Kylo.
Yeah, which is the same part to me.
It's all the same part. Because he is...
There's just so much.
It is a layered story. Yeah. So essentially Luke comes to this planet. It's a water planet. They have a unique version of the Force, which is very Taoistic. The tide. Mm-hmm. And the tide is neither dark or light. It is the tide. It is either in or out. And to be powerful with the tide, you must give yourself to the tide and allow yourself to take you where the tide needs to go.
Yeah.
That's the summation of the land, the planet. And Luke comes and rescues a young girl who was lost in a sea, in a tumultuous sea. Mm-hmm. And the young girl in this, I think, is
she's
allegory for Luke.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. She learns the lessons that... Yeah, because she...
Luke wants to teach her, and she teaches the lessons to Luke, the three lessons that we learn in The Last Jedi. Yeah. In the novelization specifically, because they ended up cutting the last lesson. Mm-hmm. And it's a retelling of the three lessons in The Last Jedi in a way that actually I think is a little bit more consumable, mm-hmm. Which is really, really interesting. Yeah. So...
But... Okay, I have one thing to say about this because I'm as you're saying this, I'm like kind of coming back to this one thing that happened in The Last Jedi, that is that Luke was frightened when Rey went to the dark. And that's something that in this story, it's very clear that the way that they look at the tide, which is the way they look at the force, is that there is no light or dark, and that
no, it's using or flowing.
Yeah. And they were frightened about the way that Luke used the force. They thought it was terrifying.
Using it for your own needs.
Yes. Instead of allowing yourself to become it
one with the force. Yeah. One with the tide, which is the force, just to clarify.
No, it's really cool because, again, it shows you how much Luke kind of lost his way, became disillusioned with the contrast of Sith versus Jedi. He got too enveloped in that controversy that he forgot about the larger picture, and he forgot about what the Force really is and what it's there for and how we could be influenced by it, I think.
The lessons that Luke in the story learns by the end is to see the light and the dark as sides of the force, as sunlit foam and shadowed eddies in the same tide. It's all the tide. It's all the force.
Yeah.
The dark and the light is all one force. To accept that the force has a greater will than the individual, and then to trust that sometimes to yield is not surrender, but to dissolve the ego in the grand web that connects us all.
That is so Campbell.
It's very Campbell. It's very Campbellian. Yeah. It's very what happens in The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
It's like he remembers it's all one force. It all has a will. I give myself over to the force. I trust in the force. And things will work out. Things have a plan. It's very fate. It's very mythologically fate-driven, right? And some people don't like that concept. Like to go against fate causes suffering. And then to go with fate is like, it's better for you. And like, I don't really have a choice in this. And you know, that whole idea of free will and stuff like that. But this is mythology. It's to say that there's the universe makes sense, which it doesn't.
Yeah, well, because it's also uncomfortable for people because it's about change and being able to accept the change and go with it. Like you said, like to go with your fate, to accept your
go with your bliss.
Yes, because you're still participating. It's not your fate does not mean that you are not in control of it. It means that you're being pointed in a direction if you allow yourself to. This is difficult because we're talking about like our concepts, and you can't help this but be personal, right? Like it's our concepts of what exists. But if we're going with, you know, believing in the force and believing that it is real in this universe, then we're saying that you're accepting that the force has a will and the force has a purpose, and allowing yourself to go towards it doesn't mean that you don't have the ability to say yes or no.
I would say that this is the most mythologically dense of the stories, you know, as far as like what it's trying to say about the force and reminding us, like resetting ourselves on what the force means and the lessons. Like I think Ken actually said, I wanted to teach people again, like what the lessons of the force were.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
No, it's very clear. I love the Taoist. The whole thing about it, especially after listening to your conversation with what's her name, the religious studies,
Sarah Gallant.
That was eye-opening. That really kind of set me up, honestly, for this book, because this particular one, it was like, oh wow, it's very the flowing and the ebbing and that, everything like that. I thought that was pretty clear what he was going for.
So I'm gonna just take a sec to talk about the Raylo
of this story. Yes, the golden marlin.
The golden marlin. And like I can quickly search to see how many times fish metaphors are mentioned in this book. But fish metaphors are like things are described as fish all over the place.
Yeah.
So when you have repetitive themes, you know that they're important.
Do you want me to search how many times the word fish is?
I mean, you can. I can just do it real quick. I mean, like other than the fact that, you know, fishing in the deluge obviously has the name, it is mentioned in all of the other stories. Like in iDroid, the air was so thick and the skiff's wings were retracted to resemble the narrow fins of a fish. And then, you know, like fish are mentioned kind of throughout the story, just kind of to describe things. And that made me go like, what is going on? What's with the fish metaphors?
It's the flow.
It's the flow, right? And it's to tell you that there is a person in the story that is caught up in the tide.
Yeah, because it's moving them. It's acting upon them.
Yeah, and that Kylo Ren, Ben Solo, is
against the tide.
Going against the tide and caught up in the tide. And at one point, Luke, as Rey metaphor, not only uses a kilometer-long pole to stab the Kylo Golden Marlin in his fin, right where his, like, lightsaber burn on his shoulder is, that's described exactly there, like, right below his gills, so it's, like, somewhere on his head. He gets stabbed, but then there's a line, and because we've read the Last Jedi novelization together, I knew that this was the line. So in her head, in the Last Jedi novelization, Rey says, you know, it's not your time yet, basically. The tide still has a place for you and is still, you're still an agent of the Force, basically. Like you're still caught up in the Force.
The Force still has... the Force is not done with you yet.
Yeah, the Force is not done with you yet. And in the book, so the spear went through the cartilage beneath the top fin, said Seeker. The fish will be sore for a few days, but it will live. How are we going to get the fish back?
We're not.
We're not. Mm-hmm. We're not. It's this, that marlin's got to be a few hundred kilograms. Do you know how much a few hundred kilograms is?
Quite a lot.
It's like 400 pounds. This is a huge marlin that he stabs with a kilometer long pole, which could represent the Force connects, etc. And there's this tie to the lines in The Last Jedi where she lets him go. Right after the throne room, he's passed out. She gives him back his lightsaber and she lets him go. Yep. She makes sure his lightsaber is on his side, like right by him. She makes sure he has his sword.
Yeah.
Because it was not anywhere near him in the scene. Mm-mm. She makes sure he's good. And Luke then says, maybe they'll meet again sometime.
Yeah.
But your fish got away. You failed the trial. It's time to go.
Yeah.
You know,
he walks away from it.
He walks away, just like Rey did.
Yeah, it's the, I didn't do what I was told to do. I didn't do what I believed was my destiny to do. But there's something else happening here that I can't interact with. There's something else keeping me from doing this. I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to listen to the cosmic force. Mm-hmm. I'm going to listen to the tide and take a different path.
Essentially, the marlin has to learn to go with the tide rather than going against it.
Yeah, because...
And then...
Because Luke did everything in his power to get that darn thing on the pole. And then, of course, she even said that he figured out how to find them. You know, he could spot them from so, like, further away than what she could when he finally figured out how to. And yet, he happened to get the one that was too big for his bird to carry. Yeah. It's just very, like, obvious that it was him. Yeah, that was what he was supposed to do, but it's not what he was supposed to do.
Right.
But he happened to harpoon the only one that he wasn't supposed to get. Right. Exactly. There's so much there.
Yeah, no, there's a lot. And the lessons themselves are really wonderful, too. Like, stop beating yourself up and go with the flow of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, really wonderful story. And most people catch this one as really important and really enjoy it. It is very wonderfully written.
Oh, yeah.
Highly, highly recommend it. But that's what you're trying to get out of this story, right? And now on to the most important story, in my opinion.
Yes!
I don't know if, did I convince you that this was the most important story?
Yeah, but I have to say, my order would be iDroid and then... Big Inside would be second for me. And then fishing.
Big Inside is also Big Inside's so important. Really important.
But yeah, iDroid to me is the most important. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, people know this. I love droids. I was really excited about this story. But I, when I read this story, I like had to put the book down. Like we have, Ty and I have like a ping conversation online of us talking about it because I'm like freaking out the whole time. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you want to describe how I reacted to this book.
Oh, yeah.
As I was
she would send
it.
Me, like, she'd copy and paste from the book and send me whole passages and then giving me one word explanations of her thoughts. And it kind of.
I didn't realize it was
it
that.
It kind
bad.
Of made sense at the time, funny enough. But no, you would say metaphor. And then you would say, you know, Ray. Kylo, 3 feet by, or three, how big is the, it's?
3 meters by 3 meters
That's
by 3 meters.
Huge.
It's huge. I'm like, how is this a thing? Yeah, no, so like this story is dark and it's mm-hmm. deep and it shows the perpetuating tragedy of the universe under the dark side, under slavery, under the ideologies of the Sith and the Jedi, and how it's basically caused the universe and the galaxy itself to suffer. That's what this story is about. It's a metaphor for the whole saga, for the whole thing. Zeta is the chosen one.
Yeah.
Anakin slash Ben.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just about the Jedi and the Sith. It's not just about the rebellion and the Empire or whoever the two sides of war are. The galaxy is sick.
Yeah.
And that was what this planet was trying to show us.
I basically lost my mind for 3 months because of this story.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe people don't read as deeply into things as I do, but when I hear the words clouded by the darkness, it makes me think of Yoda's words, clouded by the dark side.
Yeah.
The Force is clouded by the dark side. This whole thing is a metaphor for the pain and suffering of the galaxy. And Zeta herself, she's a female droid who's in this circumstance, is taken from humble beginnings, brought into this galactic civilization, into the planet. Play, forced to become an enforcer, which is a force user, is forced to be something she does not want to be. She is a mystery box in her shape. You love mystery boxes. It's a J.J. Abrams mystery box, so we can fill in the blank for whatever she is. She goes through amputation. She goes through pain. She is taken over by the dark compulsions of the dark side because she has this chip put into her.
Yeah, before she is sold into slavery, essentially. I mean, she is kind of a slave before that, but she is allowed on her free time to create art. So she has, the cube that she is allowed to be fitted with different arms and different extensions to provide different services, right? Mostly construction. Mm-hmm. But she uses those appendages to whittle things out of wood. And I thought that was fascinating because she doesn't chisel like stone or metal or anything like that. She doesn't do metalworking. She carves things out of wood, out of the stumps that she dredges up. And creates statues, and she creates the likenesses of like the people that she knows and whatnot, and the droids that she knows, and that's so beautiful because I think that there's something that they're trying to tell us about art through the stories.
Yeah, they mentioned it again. Mm-hmm. Actually, Lady Kikian actually says she has a theory that artists make the best enforcers.
Yes, and okay, so. This little society that they have created, the lady and the
in the gym.
I highlighted some of the quotes because I just think they're really important because in The Last Jedi, it was very obvious that they were trying to show us like the warlords, right? But these are the opposite. These are not people profiteering from war. They're not profiteering from their knowledge. They are profiteering and then they're escaping from that to their own little world that they have created so that they can go and be. I'll read it because it's so like important to me. I say that the gym, which is where they the shining place that they have created for themselves on this desolate planet. The gym is a haven for lords and ladies and magnates and oligarchs belonging to multiple species, far beyond the reaches of petty bureaucrats and small-minded laws. Only those who prize real freedom make their homes here. And then she goes on to say, here We can rule in a manner that mob-run democracies won't allow, perform experiments that cowardly officials won't permit, put into practice social institutions that pedantic justice judges and regulators think are beyond the pale. And then some people, one of the droids starts saying, I don't want to be wiped. Please, please, I'll do anything. Interrupts the speech. But this place is their sanctuary. This place is the place that they go to get away from the things that are already bad. We know those things are bad. We know the bureaucracies are bad. We know the warmongering is bad and all of that. But this is bad too. I talked to Corey about this in like a philosophical way one night. And I was like, I don't think I figured this out, but I think I figured it out. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think I can put it into words, but I think I know what it is.
In my opinion, what the gem is representing is the archetypical forces of the galaxy.
But it's not...
You're making me question.
Yeah, because this is a group of people who are artists and philosophers. They're the ones who think they are above the bureaucrats. They think they are above the democracies. They think...
The common people.
Not just the common people. Well, they think they are above all of it. They think they're above all of the politicking. Yeah.
Well, and they also think that all of the suffering that is brought to the deep is justified because of that.
Yes, because, right? And they say, oh, here, your hard work and willing submission are required to free us to live and think in comfort, delivering truly novel ideas and spiritual insights to the galaxy.
So this, to me, although on its face shows like the decadence of using people, like the only way you get ahead in society is by using others and consuming. Like it's very Schopenhauer from a philosophical perspective. If you look into that philosopher, Schopenhauer basically says the only way you exist is by consuming.
Yeah,
it's very much like that. But to me, it also shows, if we look at this as metaphor, it is the justification for what people use to justify what they feel is right. Because the droids are the average people of the galaxy. Yeah. The droids are the average people. Even though they say they don't have like government, they do have government in the gem. It's not a democracy. It doesn't take the droids on the deep into consideration. Mm-hmm. It uses, and it is the archetypes of the Jedi and the Sith that maintain that without taking consideration for the people. This is the this is the Republic as the Phantom Menace is starting.
Yes, absolutely. And I think I know what you're saying in regards to the Jedi and the Sith here is that the if you want to get into like the actual metaphor of it is that the king guy, the lord guy.
Ikin?
He is he is the Jedi.
Uliaki? Sorry.
He's the Uliaki. One that gives the speech. And then the lady.
The methods are different, but the result is the same.
Which is the.
People are suffering.
It's the Jedi and the Sith. The methods are different, but the.
Yeah, it is the Jedi.
But the results are the same.
The outcome is the same.
You're perpetuating war. You're perpetuating evil. You're perpetuating this disease in the galaxy.
Yeah, they view it as no change in circumstances for Zeta, who is brought in from a place of servitude previously in that, like, she had a job, she was a construction person, and she cleared land, and they view it as no different that she would be put to work for their ideals, which very much shows Anakin and his transformation from a slave, which he had a job, it wasn't great, but he had time to create on his own.
Yeah.
And build droids. Yeah. And fix
But then
things,
when he became...
Which is all he wanted
to do.
When he
became a Jedi.
All he wanted
he
to do.
He became a Jedi. All of that. Everything that he loved.
And he had his friends. Was taken away.
Yeah.
He had his friends. He had his mom.
Yeah. When you take that away from someone, you're essentially doing the same thing that the Sith do.
Yep. Even if you're the Jedi. And the Jedi did that to all of those kids that became Jedi.
And obviously, this is a very quick and literal... type of story and what it's trying to teach us. But Zeta does not feel moved at all by the speech. She sees right through it. She thinks it's evil. She thinks it's terrible. But then she's given the chip.
And then she's forced to comply.
Yeah. And then she's forced to comply. Which is interesting because I think that that's more like Ben than it is like Anakin, right? Because Anakin had an entire life that was built up before Palpatine really manipulated him by what was supposed to be good. But with Ben was from the beginning, as far as what you understand, Ben was manipulated from the beginning, deep in the recesses of his mind, being told that he had something inside of him. I mean, again, we don't really know what happened, but we know that there was something happening in Ben Solo that was against what he wanted, that was happening to him. The darkness was reaching out to him.
Yeah, we know there was a darkness in him, and maybe the dark compulsions were there.
I that's what I
when
think
when he was born.
The dark we compulsions, as they call them in this.
Yeah, the dark compulsions. Yeah, I love that. And why is this story a redemption story? Yeah. So it's a redemption story for Zeta. On its face, Zeta gets saved by Luke Skywalker. And I really just want to encourage people to go and read it because it's wonderful. But what happens is Zeta runs into Luke, who's trying to rescue R2-D2 from the mines, who is also a prisoner in the mines. I have my theories about who Rey and... RCD2 and Luke are in this story. I mean I think Luke is the cosmic force and his name is Rey, and R2D2 is Finn, and we're gonna see that Finn helps Rey fix Kylo.
I think that's great. Yeah,
that's what we're gonna see.
We'll see.
So where the story would stop in Return of the Jedi is saving one droid, saving Zeta.
Last Jedi. You said Return of the Jedi.
It doesn't stop there. No, in Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
Saving Anakin. Gotcha. It saves Anakin.
No.
But it doesn't stop there. Zeta goes all and says, well, now we have to go and try to save everybody else. And how do they do this? They, all of them, they flip the parity gate. Parity is an interesting word. It can mean equality. It can mean balance.
Ooh. Why haven't I heard you say that before?
I was saving it for my
It's out.
Droid conversation. Nope. I didn't send you all my notes.
That's
but
awesome.
So it's like with a T, not parity, a D, not a parody. It's a parity, which is parity, unequal, balance, equal, equilibrium. You know, like parity.
So they balance.
Everything is
equal. Oh.
They balance all of the people so that they can make their own choices in the future, and that they are not controlled by
the
dark side.
So what they're essentially saying is that the chip, and they do say this, that when they insert the chip, it pushes on certain processors and it lets off on others. So it imbalances them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And so it doesn't – Zeta is turned back to being a good droid again. But what the change that Zeta tells Luke, who in my opinion in this story represents the cosmic will of the Force, is able to fix all of the imbalanced Force users in the galaxy so that they can find balance and that they can actually have a choice on how they want to live their lives. Before this, because of the cloud of the dark side, they don't have a choice.
To get back to that cloud of the dark side, this is something I think I messaged you when I was reading it. In the book, it says Zeta can see that there are flaws in the chip. She can see the weaknesses. If I could do this, I could overcome it.
Yep.
But then the lady says, oh, that's by design. You're supposed to know.
It's learned helplessness.
Yes, you cannot fight this. That is the only way you will not fight it, if you know that you are helpless against it. And that's Palpatine. That's Palpatine. That's Snoke. Like, that is the true evil. A lot of people get hung up on the idea of who's the bad guy? Who's the good guy? Well, in Star Wars, like, all you need to know is if somebody is trying to literally manipulate and force pain, anger, all of, if they're trying to force the dark side on someone, that is true evil. That is what Snoke did. That is what Palpatine did.
Yes.
Darth Vader always gave Luke a choice, or just killed people. Join me.
Yeah.
Or
join me.
Yeah.
And even Ben is like, you need a teacher. I can show you the ways of the Force, even from the beginning with Rey.
Yeah.
Like, accept me, please.
True evil is just not, it's forcing that on people.
Palpatine is specifically torturing Luke until he gives in to his hate and he comes to it himself, right? Like, yeah, no, it's interesting. But how it ends doesn't make me happy for Reylo. Reylo's out there. Because Luke goes away and Zeta just ends up spending the rest of her life basically carving pictures of Luke and R2-D2.
Yeah, but she was living her bliss.
It's myth. It's legend.
Her bliss was to... Didn't she have a friend, too, that they saved?
Yeah. She saved her friend by sacrificing her her strut to, and then being captured. She gave her power cell and stuff.
I think there's a lot that we don't know about Ben yet. And I think it will reflect more of the story, which I'm excited about. But no, we don't really know what happens to Zeta. It says that...
she lives her life on the planet, carving pictures of Luke and R2.
I've made many tree stump carvings of the pair since, and I tell anyone who asks that they are of the great Jedi Luke Skywalker, who once freed thousands of slaves on a forgotten world. I feel like the end of it was just like not her story. It was more like the end of the story about Luke in her story. It was like, this is what I know of Luke.
Yes.
Yeah. No.
I know.
It's open-ended.
I know.
Yeah. So don't say it. Don't say it makes you worried about Reylo. It doesn't make me worried about Reylo. It actually makes me super happy.
Well, you know, we see Ben Demption fully in this story. And Ben is what helps
fix
the galaxy.
I think that because at the very end, Luke reattached a pair of construction arms to me. They felt strange and I flexed the appendages uncertainly. And he said, you'll get used to them. I know how it feels. And then he flexed his right hand covered by a glove, you know, the robotic hand. But I mean, if we want to take this, if we want to take this very, like, we don't want to take it literally, take it like, this is what Ben's going to go through. He doesn't have to lose appendages. But the metaphor is that it's not going to feel right. Like, this is what we talked about in our conversation with Mel. It's not going to be okay. Like, it's not going to be, if Ben gets his redemption, which he will, obviously, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be okay. It's going to be the rest of his life. And it's not going to leave off.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be very kind of.
And it's going to be hard.
It's going to be bittersweet.
Yeah.
At the end. Because you have to live with what you've done.
I think that him living each day.
Yeah.
He has to live with what he's done each day. Right. And which was the choice.
It's never going to go away. Yeah. It's never going to be okay. That's to me what this is trying to tell us. Like, she put the arms back on and she didn't feel right. Like, it was just, even though that was who she was before, not very long ago, she didn't feel like it fit correctly. So yeah, no, I think it's there. I think it's positive. Mm-hmm. I have hope. Hope, 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 hope.
Just go read this book. It's fine. So Lugubrious Moat, I think I covered it really well with
Ken.
Ken.
I think so.
I don't really need to go into it too much, but Lugubrious Moat is this cute little moat who controls the Luke in the Jabba the Hutt palace scene. It's like a role-playing game. It's like a video game. It's like, how do we self-fulfill the role in the universe by playing pretend? It's wonderful.
I'll say just like a couple of things about this. First of all, the little flea is a girl. It's something I didn't realize until the very end. And I was like, holy crap.
And she has more respect for Leia.
Yes.
She has more respect for Leia than for
Luke. Yeah, no, that was amazing. I thought it was really sweet, especially because Ken has two little girls. So I felt like a lot of that came from there. But also, I felt like the big lesson was that, like, no one is insignificant. And again, forcing the idea of, you know, challenging the reader to care about this insignificant thing on this other insignificant thing, and then jumping to the main characters. You know, it's like, even though you already know the story, you care, because that's the point. Nothing is ever insignificant. No person's perspective is insignificant.
And that what you bring to the story is also important.
Exactly.
It's lovely.
It is.
And fun and cute. And the language is luscious and delectable. Yeah. Delicious.
That's a good way of putting it.
It is delicious language. Yeah. The prose are wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, so your favorite story, The Big Inside.
This story was really cool because it started out one way and then it went somewhere completely different, and I thought that was really neat. Like, that they set it all up and they went through all of this trouble.
Who tells this story? I think it is actually
Gokolu. So he tells the story. It's not a primary source, but it's a story from someone that he knew who met Luke Skywalker in the belly of a worm.
A space slug.
It starts out like talking about how this slug that lives in the meteor is like huge and enormous, and the scientist keeps talking about how we are all as complicated on the inside as this slug is. Like, we all have like these ecosystems inside of us.
Yeah.
And Luke is so in tune with this. He's like, I can't kill anything in here.
Yeah.
Even though it's all important. Yeah, it's all important. Even though it's like life and death, he freaks out at having to kill some of the monsters that they come across because he thinks that he's going to destroy it from the inside out.
Yeah.
And they're following.
He doesn't know what's important.
Yes. Because they're following this writing.
And it's very
Journey to
the Center of the Earth. They're following the past. They're going into the past. Like, they go through these primordial different phases throughout the journey in further into the Exogorth. They go further and further into the Exogorth, the space slug, similar to the one in Empire Strikes Back. To me, this is metaphor for going back in time to an earlier phase of Force users in the galaxy that I hope we get to see one day.
Yeah.
It is Journey to the Center of the Earth. It is understanding the truth. And we actually get like a Luke-sized revelation in it as far as sacrifice and understanding the sacrifices of his mentors in the past.
Yes.
In it.
Oh, that's huge. When I got there, I was like, oh my God. Like, first there's these statues that reminded me of the Doctor Who episode of Don't Blink, where there's like the angel statues. I don't know if you've watched it, but it's scary as hell. That's like the scariest thing upon watching it the first time. Yeah, no, they fall asleep under these statues and they wake up and the statues are hovering above them, and they find out they're not statues, but they're living things that have weaved themselves these cocoons that look like they're made from stone.
Mm-hmm. But it's using the force or mist to build something.
The luminous mist.
Right? So it's, and the luminous mist.
It's a very specific word, I think, because that word luminous is used a few times in reference to believing in yourself and being powerful. So.
And the force.
Yeah. Yeah. And using the force. Because
everybody is luminous beings.
Because we are more than just the matter that makes us up.
Luminous beings. This crude matter.
Exactly. That one quote is all that you need for this entire story, because again, Luke values the life of what he is inside, and then he values the life of these beings that he only gets a glimpse of because they have slowed themselves down so much that they can only get a small message out to him.
And that's metaphor in and of itself. It's like, it's like the storytellers are trying to say, if we can only give you one message, what can we tell you?
Yeah.
Because we can only slow ourselves down so long so that you can get a glimpse through this entire journey that you've seen.
And what do they tell him? They tell him their story.
Yeah.
That's it. They don't tell him the mysteries of the universe. They don't tell him the purpose that they've learned through living for so long. They don't tell him any of these huge things that they've learned. They just tell him their story, where they came from, why they're there, and kind of how to help them, right? Because they do tell him how to fix their problem.
Yeah, kill and, us.
Yeah, that's what they take their time to tell him. It's crazy.
So that we might allow you to be free.
Yeah, yeah. We can
take the story on and live your life.
Yes.
Because you're important. You, as the participant in the story, is actually what is important. That's the point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that story is trying to teach kids the cycle of life and death and to show them that it's okay, like that people come and go and stories come and go. What's important is that you share your story with somebody else.
And that it's very Coco. You're never really gone as long as somebody remembers you.
Yeah.
You're never really gone because you got to tell your story to somebody and tell them why it was all important.
Right. Yeah.
It's just, it's wonderful. And there's some interesting force concepts to do with the mist and how it, you know, like very energy equals, it's all energy, energy, energy.
Yeah. But
energy can be things.
Well,
it can weave things from the energy.
The tide story talked about it too. You can move pools of it. You can't use it, but I think the elder says it doesn't mean you can't use it. It means you can't use it, but you can move parts of it to concentrate pools of energy to you.
That was Luke.
Can do. Yeah. I think, yeah, that was Luke.
Yeah, but. And the mist weavers actually take the energy of the force and the energy of the galaxy.
Right.
And they make it into things.
Right.
But I think that what is important to get out of this story is collective and iterative storytelling. The method by which we tell legends to ourselves about ourselves. Because this is all just human experience through a new frame story, a new understanding of what is important to grow up with and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point of the Legends of Luke Skywalker.
Yeah.
Listen, enjoy, retell the stories.
Yeah.
Enjoy the stories with others. That's the frame story. And that by the end of the Wayward Current journey, the listeners in the story and ourselves feel more connected with the magic of Star Wars than at the beginning.
Yeah, I think so.
And that's the point. Share stories with others. Star Wars is fundamentally connected to who you experience it with.
And I'm glad to be experiencing it with you.
I'm glad to be experiencing it with you. Well, thank you, Ty. Do you have any final thought?
No, I think that was a pretty good summation of what we experienced. So, yeah, good.
Go and read it.
Yeah, it's really good. It's wonderful. It's so good. Yep. I'll quote it forever. I'll tell you what.
So, Ty, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @black_TYM. And you can find me on YouTube at @WitAndFolly.
And I've been Marie-Claire Gould. And this has been What the Force, The Power of Myth and Symbolism, The Legends of Luke Skywalker by Ken Liu. I highly recommend that you pick up the book and read it and experience it with your own set of eyes, because you will get something out of this book.
Yeah.
There is nobody that I've heard that has read it that hasn't.
Yep.
We are at whattheforce.ca. Our Twitter is WTForceShow. Our email is WTForcePodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook at What the Force Podcast, as well as feel free to reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook and start a conversation. We love talking about Star Wars. If you want to leave a review on iTunes or any of your podcatchers, it helps other people find the show. Till next time, remember, myths are the stories we tell to ourselves about ourselves. Cheers.